Welcome to Voices. I'm Alan Wilcox, Editor-in-Chief of Epidemiology. In 2002, the journal began a project to interview our field's most senior and accomplished practitioners. In these interviews, scientists reflect on their careers, their professional influences, and on the future of epidemiology. The interview you're about to hear is with Jeremy Morris. Dr. Morris was a British epidemiologist and physician who conducted a classic study of heart attack incidents in London bus drivers and conductors in the 1940s, demonstrating for the first time a link between exercise and cardiac health. Dr. Morris, who was a firm believer in the health benefits of exercise, died in 2009, just short of his 100th birthday. This interview was conducted by George Davy Smith in 2003.
Jerry, few people start with the intent of becoming an epidemiologist. So can you describe for us your path coming that brought you to epidemiology?
Well, actually, it was very simple. I was already, as a young graduate, I was already into rheumatic heart disease, which I had sort of adopted as my favourite problem, influenced very much by a lot of the patients I'd seen at UCH and by what I'd picked up, that there were a lot of social connections with rheumatic heart disease. So I started quite ignorantly trying to get community pictures of it, long before I'd heard of epidemiology or anything like that. And was soon analysing registrar general statistics on mortality from heart disease in children in relation to social conditions and so forth. Eventually, this led to the first paper. I did that, but by then I was working with Richard Titmuss, and the first paper we produced together was on the social aspects of juvenile rheumatism and rheumatic heart disease. I can't remember what we called it. It was in the Lancet in the summer of 1942. So I came into epidemiology through social medicine and public health. Epidemiology was obviously the technique, the methodology, the approach that I needed.
And were you working clinically when you started to do this work?
I worked clinically right through. I qualified in 1934, and by the beginning of 1939, I took my membership and I came straight here and enrolled for the DPH in September 1939, by which time there were other things were happening. So in fact, I came to do the DPH here in 1946.
Right.
And it also meant that I did 5 years more clinical medicine during the war. I was a physician. I was a medical specialist during the war, so I had 5 years extra clinical medicine, which meant in fact that actually I had 10 years clinical medicine before I came into this field.
Now, was there any formal epidemiology taught in DPHs? There's a diploma in public health. Was there any formal epidemiology in DPHs at that time?
In our DPH, well, Bradford Hill was our main teacher.
Okay.
And an exceptionally good teacher. I've often looked back on him as being a model teacher. He used to prepare his commas. so that we got an introduction to epidemiology teaching then. And Robert Cruikshank, who taught us infectious diseases, he was also very much epidemic. So it was quite a bit, but it didn't relate to the kind of epidemiology that I was soon to get into when I set up our MRC unit.
And what do you think is the biggest difference between epidemiology as it was practiced when you started your career and how epidemiology is today?
Well, it's entirely different. I mean, today, epidemiology is a mature science with journals and textbooks and university degrees, university departments and university degrees. And it's all over. It's all over medicine. It's every article. Every article. It's just the commonplace to have an epidemiological attachment to whatever the clinical article is. And there, in my time, there was nothing like this. We were creating epidemiology as we went along. There were a tiny handful of us. I suppose you might say, with a vocation nowadays, epidemiology is a major industry. Huge numbers of talented people. And this universally accepted. One of the things I can probably talk about later is how epidemiology became accepted as a major force in medicine, because the pioneers hadn't done this. I mean, Major Greenwood and people like that, they hadn't made an impact on medicine, on Bender, the medical sciences, or maybe very little. And we'll talk a little about this later.
And who would you single out as having the strongest influence on your career?
Well, I suppose, in all fairness, I must say Mellenby, the secretary of the MRC, who, out of the blue, on the basis of what I'd published by myself and what I'd published with Richard Timmers and what I suppose he picked up from his pals, invited me to think about setting up a unit. Then the MRC, usually they had a selection, they had a committee to consider this, which meant for a whole day. Jim Spence was the chairman of the committee. Actually, the most penetrating questions were by a leading surgeon, Lermont, who was a professor of surgery in Glasgow. I found it very interesting, he was the most acute in the discussion. But James Spence was the chairman, Leslie Witz was on the committee. The rest I can't recall. We spent a whole day and they set up the unit. They recommended the MRC, we set up the unit.
And in terms of epidemiologists, who do you think as being the two or three most important epidemiologists during your lifetime?
Well, I must say that Major Greenwood, I read everything he published. Goldberger, when I discovered him, I thought he was much unappreciated in this country. And Bradford Hill, I suppose, although he was mainly statistical, I would think these three.
And what do you see as Greenwood's contribution?
Well, it showed how you could tackle problems in cancer and problems in cancer from the population point of view, although in fact he could contribute very little. It was really pioneering stuff. He also wrote so beautifully that it made one feel inferior for the rest of his days. And his Latin quotations and his Greek quotations came out quite spontaneously. they were all there. He was very kind to me. I remember the very first job I did. I got my membership in January 1939, and I was at 9 months to fill in before coming to the school, so I did a job in Nottingham as physician to the city council. They were changing the pension schemes for the council workers, and they wanted a medical examination of all their council workers. And I remember going to see Major Greenwood, and I didn't know him, who very kindly agreed to see me. And we had a long discussion about the sort of things I might look at and look for. And this was a great experience. I mean, I found most extraordinary things. To me, as a clinician, a bunch of cases of neurosyphilis from the First World War, undiagnosed, unreported, checked by, I got all such things, of course, checked by the local chief physician. I remember bringing that back to UCH and they didn't know what the heck was going on. And this was a very instructive.
Because Great in Epidemics and Crowd Diseases, and I think 35, he has that chapter, his one chapter on cancer, which he'd also published as a paper about the same time. Did he have any other interest in chronic disease, though? He didn't seem to develop that anywhere.
No. Well, he had something as an occupational disease. In fact, he may have had a job in occupational He was, I'm pretty sure he was attached to the occupation.
Yeah, he did.
I'm a bit vague, but I'm pretty sure he was attached to that. He was interested in that. But when I came, I spent an afternoon discussing what I might do in Nottingham. And he was quite taken with the possibilities. He was a real population, even if rather an odd one. And he was very keen, I should try and get something on what I suppose you would, today you would talk about emotional factors, and which were quite beyond me to do anything about.
And you mentioned Goldberger. What do you think his...
Well, apparently that was a marvelous thing, including the experimental work. And he wrote so beautifully, and quite unappreciated in this country. I can't remember now how I got hold of him. Well, Goldberger and Seidenstreicher, I suppose one should say. Seidenstreicher was more the most socially, more deliberately social medic of the two of them, I would think. But it's interesting, apropos something I'll talk about later, that these people had very little impact on medicine as a whole.
Yeah.
And then how medicine should tackle problems. And we're more or less started from scratch in terms of establishing how coronary heart disease, for instance, has got to be looked at as a population terms, as well as in clinical terms, in laboratory terms. The very first observation we made on coronary heart disease was this business between drivers and conductors. Well, the main difference there was in sudden death as first clinical manifestation of coronary heart disease. And this alerted me, how on earth do you pick this up any other way? I was already in touch with the London Hospital, with the biggest cardiological practice in Britain, maybe even in Europe. Huge clinical practice, and this remarkable post-mortem study of cancer. And I couldn't visualize how in the London Hospital they could pick this up.
Yeah.
And so, well, I went down to, we might talk about this later, but later on, not through pathology, I got onto this business about silent infarcts. And what they meant, I had no idea. We still have very little idea. And again, how do you study this? And the clinching one actually was really quite amusing. I was at the London, and as I said, they had this huge cardiological from history where Sir James Mackenzie, came there. Mm. And it struck me, we never see a ruptured heart. According to the textbooks, this is a regular complication. And it just suddenly struck me that neither in the wards, where you wouldn't expect that it was in the wards, but in the postmortem. So I phoned up the coroner's pathologist who covered the same district as the London Hospital, same population. I said, look, what's going on? We never get a ruptured heart. I said, ruptured heart? I get two a week. And again, you see, but it's very interesting. I showed all this to Hemsworth, who was the secretary of the MRC, my boss, I suppose you might say, in effect. And very interested. He was a diabetologist originally before he came in. And during the war, he'd done a social job. He was responsible for the diet of diabetes and such issues, advising government. And he was very interested in all of this. He insisted, I then were talking about the late 1950s, maybe the 1960s, but he said, you must show this to McMichael. Sir John McMichael was the leader, the Führer of clinical science, yeah. Professor at Hammersmith, where the brightest young physicians from all over the world used to come to do a postgraduate stint. And I remember showing him all this, and he said, rubbish.
That was it.
That was it, and we lived very excited. We were very fortunate compared with you people. When we came out of the war, there were three major diseases, epidemic diseases, you could borrow the term from Greenwood, virtually unknown. coronary heart disease, lung cancer, and duodenal ulcer. I suppose when you say peptic ulcer, really duodenal ulcer. And the other way, just waiting. And I, because of my interest in heart disease, I think the coronary heart disease eventually was virtually unknown. There were little bits and hints about biochemistry, little bits and hints about diet, but there was nothing really known about it. And there was no literature, which is a wonderful situation. You go to the RSM, you could read the literature. You see, before you had tea, you see, cover the literature and you leave some German paper or something to be translated by a pal. So we were starting really from scratch. You've got nothing like that now. At least, I suppose you had with Alzheimer's, but you've got a total different kind of problems now to be in that kind of situation. And nothing is as clean and as empty as these situations were.
Which, I suppose, that brings us to Bradford Hill, because you mentioned Bradford Hill as your third most important epidemiologist during your lifetime. What do you think?
But even he, no, it's interesting. I don't know whether I've mentioned it, but the first problem I had to grapple with was incidence. And how do you define incidence of disease like coronary heart disease, which I knew from my pathology, by the time you get to middle age, virtually the entire population has got coronary artery disease. I mean, it's very interesting when you meet somebody middle age at postmortem who hasn't got coronary artery disease, and you find they came from Thailand or somewhere. But how do you define incidence in a situation like that? Bradford Hill, in his textbook, which I knew of by heart, I'd learned of by heart during the war, doesn't distinguish between incidence and attack rate until well into the 1960s. And eventually, I remember I spent, in 1947, I went to the States. I spent time in the States, and I spent a week at Hopkins with Laurel Reed and Margaret Merrill, who were the, you might say, the opposite numbers of Major Greenwood and Bradford Hill in Hopkins. And I brought this problem to them. And we spent virtually the week discussing. They knew nothing about coronary heart disease, which was very interesting. And eventually we agreed that tuberculosis was the only sort of model that they could think of that might be helpful. And in terms of incidence, that the only thing you could realistically go for would be first clinical manifestation. Then there were endless discussions on what you're missing out and what you're risking by going for this very late manifestation. And of course, this was long before we talked about life cause disease and all that sort of thing. I mean, the words weren't there, and certainly the ideas weren't there. Mm. At least if there were ideas there, we didn't have them there. So I say there were very exciting times and very much more favourable than the time that you've got than what you have to face up to.
Which do you think's been your most influential paper?
Well, it has to be the physical activity paper. And that was very interesting. It was published in The Lancet at great length, which is a mistake. But The Lancet have adopted our unit. The Lancet were very taken by the sort of things I was doing during the war. And Fox wrote to me when I was still in India or Burma, and the war was coming to an end, and asked me to come and see him when I got back home. And he virtually adopted our unit, and we published pretty well everything we did for a long time in The Lancet. And he became a personal friend and a political friend. He engineered our transfer to the London Hospital and so forth. But that paper was very interesting. It had no impact in this country at all on cardiology.
This is the 1953
yes.
paper.
The newspapers took it up. I had no idea how to handle them. They made a fool of me, but still, not to my discredit, I hope. But the Americans were very excited about this. The director of NIH flew over to see me, because this was the first time of an indication of something that's related to this new epidemic, physical activity. He flew over and became great friends, Jim Watt. No, not the director of NIH, the director of the Heart Institute.
NHLBI.
Whatever it was called, yeah. It kept on changing its name. The director of that, he flew over to see me. And of course I was immediately inundated with invitations to come over to the States, etc., etc., and to lecture and write papers. But it took years for British cardiology to become even, you might say, politely interesting, never mind supportive.
I mean,
that's been quite important in terms of all sorts of things.
So I mean, a review a few years before that paper, a review actually said, of coronary heart disease, said that exercise was a cause of heart attacks rather than something which protected against heart attacks. So I suppose it was a sort of new idea.
And they weren't interested, really. Essentially, they weren't interested. And that was the fair thing to say, because I knew quite a lot of them one way or another through the London. And were very polite. Parkinson was very polite and invited me home to give him a tutorial. He lived in Hampstead, quite near where I lived, and he remembered going to his palatial. He was then the top consultant. Does the name mean anything, Parkinson?
Yeah.
He's wrote all clinical papers on this. I remember inviting me to give him a personal tutorial. I remember the chocolate and the chocolate biscuits and the coffee as much as I remember making an impression.
So that's your most influential paper. Which do you think has been your most underappreciated paper that should have been more influential than it was?
Well, that thing we did on minimum incomes. I was thinking in terms of one of your questions that I was alerted that, you know, the fox and the hedgehog, and I'm a two-headed hedgehog, if such a thing is conceivable, and I suppose it is now thoroughly conceivable. You see, yes. Interested in exercise on the one hand and equality on the other, using equality as a general term. And that paper, which at least arises out of this equality thing, I was quite shocked. The government introduced the national minimum wage, which they pledged to do in the election manifesto that they elected in 1997, and very soon they appointed the usual commission of the great and the good. Work out details and so forth. And there was a lot of discussion in the papers, at least two major debates in the House of Commons. To cut a long story short, the whole thing seems to be produced without benefit of any sort of health input at all. And I ascertained later on, with much difficulty, that neither the Department of Health nor the Faculty of Public Health Medicine had made any input into this. And there wasn't any health input. The idea that this national minimum wage should at least consider, I don't say it should be the most important, by then I've been house trained, everyone says the most important, that it should consider the possibility of meeting health needs. So we set up a group here in the school to study this, and we eventually produced a report, which if you haven't seen, I'd be glad to send you a copy. You definitely not have seen it. And it raised the whole issue of what do we do with all this vast knowledge which we've created in the last 50 years. It sort of expanded out into that. See, because remember, I can talk about, literally, we started after the war. I mean, coronary heart disease was already important in the 1930s. We already had emergencies coming into UCH from Euston Station, and Thomas Lewis, my teacher, was very interested in it, and he repeated the sort of things that Osler had said years before about what we now call type A, stress, the stressful businessman, you know. But virtually nothing was known, as I've said before.
We're talking about your least appreciated paper.
Well, you see, from that time, from the... But there was no research in the 1930s. Virtually nothing. There were some clinical papers. There was no research into etiology that you could call research. So all this happened in the sort of half century since the Second World War.
Yeah.
And this paper enlarged into a major, another, not equally important, you can't compare importance. What are we doing with this growth of knowledge? This tremendous scientific consensual knowledge and scientific, major scientific knowledge. And what are we doing with it? And so that's as now as interesting an aspect of that paper, which we didn't really appreciate until by the time you get settled down, how do you cost a nutritious diet? And what have we learned about nutritious diet? Actually, the nutritious diet research, in fact, there was some done before the war, so what happened, so it made the question even more gratuitous. I mean, you're talking not about 50 years of research, but 70, 80, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And we've now got a study, a group in the school, studying this in relation to old age pensioners. And again, I've got the emphasis on the what's the minimum income required? Needless to say, the government refused to fund this tiny application for funds. The government refused to. But age concern, fund this, we need to pick up one executive officer, one research fellow, to tap all the resources that are there in the school. I'm working on this virtually half time, but a lot of work being done on in terms of the housing needs and the social and health care. There'll be a major input trying to cost this and formulate this, etc. And with the whole issues of psychosocial relations, which we now know, I can see that we know how important relation to health and the whole problem of how you define these and cost these, because you've got to cost them if you're going to have any impact into government.
So how have you chosen the research questions that you want to address?
Well, in terms of these two main interests, and that's what I'm doing now. The other thing I'm doing now is I'm involved. I've had so much contact with exercise physiologists who do very elaborate studies on people. And when we carried out the National Fitness Test, National Fitness Survey, way back in 1990, published a few years later, we had the best physiologists in the country all working on it, and it physiologically, in terms of, for instance, the determination of fitness, which is the key. We did what was the best scientific practice, as designed by our best physiologists. And of course, this is in public health terms. This is hopeless. But my contact with I have so much contact with physiologists, and I've got such good personal relations with all these physiologists, that I have the outrageous idea that you could simplify these methods for use in regular routine public health. And we're now trying to do this. I won't say anything about the support that we're getting from the Department of Health. I'll omit that. So that's my exercise interest, which amalgamates the exercise and the public health.
But at the start, if you go back to the start of that work on exercise, how did you decide, what led to you deciding you wanted to...
Well, my hypothesis is that this would be related to occupation. We set up a study in a great variety of occupation groups, both to give us information on incidence, on frequency, on prevalence, and there were little hints in terms of social class distribution, concentration on the upper classes, and there were one or two other things which I didn't know about, so later on we discovered from rummaging in the literature. Anyhow, it seems to me that occupation was a good way into this disease. It was far commoner in men than women. It increased in frequency as middle age advanced. There were some little suggestions about social class. So we set up studies in a wide variety of occupations, land and transport notably, but a great range of civil service occupations, the National Union of Teachers, Marconi. We had set up a whole range. How we did all this on clerical labour, I mean, this is all pre-computer and all that. I mean, at various periods, we had a whole army of clerks working, literally an army of clerks, the chief clerical officer up there, and the whole army of clerks filling in long hand. But this, fortunately, was the first observation we made. After 1 year, the first results we got from London Transport showed the striking differences between drivers and conductors. And then I suppose for the tensest moments in my professional life, we had to wait until we got comparable data from the civil service, in particular from the post office. And there came out the same, that we got the same difference between drivers and conductors. We got between clerical officers and that sort of thing and postmen. So by then we felt we were onto something. But these were very different times. There's no question of rushing into print or even with a preliminary statement. We spent years in testing this before we dared to publish. It's inconceivable nowadays in modern time and modern days that we just sat on this. And we tried to do as many as different studies as we could, being ignorant that Charles Darwin had shown us how to do this a long time ago, and long before we had the triangulation, etc. But we did produce evidence of different sorts which confirmed the hypothesis, and we only published as a hypothesis in 1950-1953. And we spent the best part of the next 10 years, unfortunately, a lot of other groups in different parts of the world, similarly, Pfaffenberger started up in San Francisco, and Taylor and Company. Taylor and I became good friends. I remember, you don't want gossip on this sort of thing, do you?
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not. But Taylor, I remember we were at a conference in Washington. This would be sometime in the 1950s, and Henry Taylor, we had become good friends. Unlike Ansel Keys, he was on his own diet, but Taylor said, you've got to learn some exercise physiology. And we sat in my hotel room for a whole day, a solid day in Washington, and Henry Taylor started at Dot and tutored me into the elements of exercise physiology. So that I wasn't just a sheer ignoramus, I was merely an average ignoramus. I've learned a lot from my friends one way and another.
And exercise came out as a important factor in those studies. What other possible causes were you investigating with respect to the coronary epidemic in those early studies?
Well, of course, we were very interested in the social aspects. That was my other main interest. And there was nothing very rewarding in that couldn't be explained by physical activity in those days. Then we quickly took up the emergent notice from clinical epidemiology that was founded at the same time as we started our kind of work. Framingham started their kind of work. And we, as soon as we could, we took their ideas and tested them out on the busmen. And sure enough, the bus drivers and the bus conductors had very different lipid profiles, very different blood pressure patterns, you see, different, etc. We tested them out. So again and again, it was focusing on the differences of physical activity, which of course was more and more interesting as I learned more and more about exercise physiology of physical activity. And as the exercise physiologists began to take this up. And
as the other main focus of your work, inequalities, social inequalities in health, how did you start off researching that area?
Well, we continued all the time. We did studies on different towns, for instance. We worked a lot on official data. Studies in general practice were aborted. Well, they weren't exactly aborted, but they were diminished. the idea was that Richard Titmuss should be responsible for them, but he only stayed in the unit for a short time. As soon as he published his war history, he got invitations all over Britain to chairs, and he went to LSC thereafter. Relations were remained close friends, but not little in terms of work. And I continued statistical work on that, Registrar General Statistics, and speaking in all diffidence, when the government set up the committee, and Douglas Black set up the committee and had something to do with setting up the committee, it was Abel Smith who stimulated government to do it, and I was a pal of Abel Smith. As you can imagine, with Richard, Abel Smith was Timothy's main disciple, and we were very, very close friends. So it was natural that I joined the Black Committee, which is not really a committee, it was a tiny little group, and I drafted a lot of that report. And by then, at a time, I spent a lot of my time on that draft report, which in many ways is amateurish compared with more sophisticated. But I think in terms of social policy and social medicine, it's an important document. Anne was very unpopular, treated very badly by government, as you can imagine. And it's all very well to say to each other, damn them, but it was all very unpleasant.
Which of your contributions to the field would you most like to be remembered for?
Well, it has to be physical activity, because it started a whole... It started not really epidemiological, but physiological. This was a stimulus to the American physiology. Physiology was large. Well, there was also some Scandinavian, but the physiology was very large in America. It started a lot of work, and it still remains a major public health problem. And we're not getting anywhere. And it's in terms of social medicine, it's quite the biggest social changes. We're the first generation in history where the generality of the population doesn't need to take any exercise. I mean, there's always been aristocracy or this and that, but the generality of the population nowadays doesn't need to do any physical activity, or virtually none, you know what I mean? Whether it's in occupation, or in housekeeping, or in transport, or getting about. And this has all happened in the last, well, again, you might say this last half century that I keep on talking about. And all the emphasis remains on Zaki Yuchun in what's commonly an unhelpful and unfriendly social environment. And there's been virtually no social policy change. Something which is a most social of conditions. It might be precipitated now with the epidemic of obesity. It might be. There's no signs of it yet. I was involved in some of these international things, of course.
What's your assessment of the current state of health of epidemiology?
I'm very worried about the reducing contacts with public health and social medicine. It seemed to me to be reducing when the problems are as great as ever, are greater. On the other hand, in terms of sophistication of the techniques, of the discipline itself, they're incomparably greater. Very sophisticated, very elaborate. And, of course, we're not making the kind of discoveries that we used to make. Now, why that is usually dismissed as the easy, we were in on the easy stuff, and sure we were. I mean, you don't get a disease like coronary heart disease presented to you. Although, in fact, Alzheimer's was, and it's never been very clear to me why we've made such a little contribution with Alzheimer's disease. It's never been something your journal might try and tease out. We made very modest contributions to Alzheimer's, You may say it's for want of trying, but it's been quite a lot of effort. I've never seen it teased out, this issue, for epidemiologists, because our contribution has been quite modest.
Mm.
As for moving into major social fields like violence, we just haven't. Which would have been a natural progression if we'd gone on developing instead of being taken over what you might call the RCT school. I know that you and Shah have got a lot of ideas of the same kind, or similar. The other noticeable thing, of course, is that from the beginning we were interested in health services research. And the MRC were all against this. Mellenby, no. First of all, he said this should be this kind of work should be done by the Ministry of Health. And you don't mean to tell me that they're starting this National Health Service without doing Now, since he had lunch probably once a week with the chief medical officer, that's the time when the country was going from the Athenaeum. I used to have lunch in the Athenaeum with the folks there until the last hour. He used to invite me to lunch every 2 or 3 months, and there would be all these people. But he said, essentially, let's get MRC into politics. We don't want it. But Richard Titmus, he was still going to be assistant director, deputy director of the unit at that time. We insisted, we said, we're going to come into a chronic disease era when health services are terribly important for people's health. It's quite clear to us, although we're in the very beginnings of modern treatment. How can you ignore it? And on the other hand, I've seen quite a bit of operational research during the war. John Squire and his operational research unit were both in the hospital. You remember the name John Squire? He was the first director of the Northwick Park. A very young, brilliant young professor of medicine, and during the war he was director of an operational research unit, and that unit was billeted in us in Imphal, in northeast India, for quite a period. And we had endless discussions about appropriate a lot of the methodology was to apply to the kind of problems of health services, which were full of these problems. Just before the war, PEP, does the name mean anything? PEP, which was then a big think tank.
What does it stand for?
Political and Economic Planning.
Okay.
It's a big think tank, funded, I think, by Marks and Spencer, by the CIFs. They were certainly in on it. And they did a major review of health services, which has been completely forgotten. It must have been published in 1937, 38, or before the war. And it was glaringly obvious that here was a real situation for research, for study. And the first thing we did when we established our unit was, well, as I say, Mellenby was all against it. But, very interestingly, the MRC had a different principle as well, or another principle, and that was to choose people and then let them get on with it. And I remember him saying once to Richard and myself, I don't know what you boys are up to, but you'd better get on with it. But very interestingly, Himsworth, who was later on in quite a different personality and a clinician, Mellenby was a biochemist, a physiologist. Himsworth, a professor of medicine, that's how I knew Himsworth. His future wife was my first HP at UCH. I knew him quite well. He was also, he says, the MRC is very happily situated. We belong to the Privy Council, which is the least political government department. We get an annual grant increasing every year. Why should we get into these politics? As soon as you get into health service, you get into politics. Why should we? And we have it. And Hemsworth rather turned it round to say, well, by then, the Maudsley was also into this. And Hemsworth rather turned it down, well, perhaps this will bring us different angles on etiology, which seemed to me, you know, but anyhow, but later on, And a later secretary of the MRC, it was such an odd remark that I won't put his name, said to me, there's no intellectual challenge in health services research. And at the time I thought this was, and only very recent, years later, I remembered that remark. I found myself saying, at this discussion in the school, you can guess about what, saying there are no 5 stars in health services research. Now this was a remark I made just like that, I hadn't thought of it. It was a friendly discussion.
Yeah.
But the school did badly, as you know, in the last. You got a 5-star, we only got a 5. And we were discussing the future. And it turned out that the 5s were going to do badly because the government amalgamated the previous. Did you have 5-star in the previous? So you're just 5-star 1. But Oxford was double 5-star, and Cambridge were double 5-star. So Oxford was 3rd, and Bristol was 3rd, with only 1 5-star. And we were nowhere, with only 2 5s actually. We were nowhere. And I remember during this discussion, and I saying there are no 5 stars in health services research, and I wonder to what extent that corresponds to the remark that this secretary of the MRC had made to me, that there are no intellectual challenges. Mm. And I disagreed with him. He said, well, what are they? And now we could produce one. Mind you, we were walking. We were walking down the Oxford Cross at lunchtime. And I only could produce 1 5-star observation in health services research.
What's that?
Goffman. And you know, since then, I mean, I'm sure if we sat down,
I think a couple more.
We could produce a couple more. But in this gossiping around the quads in the half hour after lunch at some MRC meeting, I can't remember what the meeting was, and I was working with, I won't mention his name, the secretary of the MRC, or he may already have retired. No, I think he was still the secretary. Now, needless to say, he never heard of Goffman. Just as Howard Florey and company, my first confrontation with the MRC, I never heard of Farr or Goldberger or Snow, a bit doubtful. I think they changed it when I mentioned Snow. But I mean, apart from Goffman, we'd find it difficult, I think. Mm. In terms of making sure that you get 5 stars next time, if it's the same system, this school's investment in health services research has got to be looked at.
What do you think are the ripest opportunities for epidemiology?
Today?
Yeah.
Moving into new areas, and this major issue of how we begin to apply so much of what we've learned, which involves all sorts of intellectual problems, and what is a scientific consensus, what is major scientific observation which is not consensus, and protest consensus. How do you relate this to policy developments, which is equal difficult but quite different policy issues? I mean, we're working on that now in relation to this old age thing, trying to formulate some of these ideas. But you see, you get a simple notion like seatbelts, and the government passes the law. And within 6 months, if you're not wearing a seatbelt, you're
banged up.
You see? But now the government is equally enthusiastic about 5 a day, and they haven't a clue. And they don't think socially. For years I've been trying to persuade them to have free swimming. So this is, there's collateral evidence that might work. You don't need anything from free eye tests or free museum entries. But anyhow, if we give such a message, and now they've got a tiny little pilot for children, and one London barrier which couldn't think of anything else.
What do you think are the biggest risks that epidemiology faces?
Well, I think I've mentioned these already. I mean, the way that biology, genetics, molecular science has taken over, which means it's taken over funds. I mean, I'm not au fait with this, and I don't know anything about Wellcome funding, but I know a bit about MRC funding, and this is a major issue. And Cavell issue, which I mentioned, was the model of the RCT has been the answer to all the scientific establishment. And how you apply RCTs to sink estates, somebody else will work out. I've no doubt they'll be ready to do it. It's a 3-year project.
What would be the single most important piece of advice you could give to a new epidemiologist starting their career?
Hinterland. It's a wrong word, but it belongs elsewhere. I think you must come in with something else. You need stats, of course. In my time, it was statistics or medicine. Nowadays, it could be statistics or medicine or molecular science or sociology. I think of the most important of these is sociology. Or maybe social psychology. I've never been very clear about what social psychology is. I've got clear ideas of sociology. It seems to me that our collaboration there over the years, we've talked about it endlessly. And in fact, we were investigating before we knew what it was. And we used their concept, we discovered concepts that they discovered years before. But it's right open, it seems to me. And it's very little of it.
So you mean come in with an ancillary skill? Be it sociology or molecular biology
or medicine
or something.
As well as statistics. And it's taken for granted you have statistics.
Yes.
And as I say, in my time, all the rest of us, they're only a tiny handful. I mean, now, as I say, it's an industry, but in my time, when we started, in this country, there was nobody else doing coronary heart disease. There was Doran Hill doing lung cancer. There were the Framingham people in Boston. There were Ansel Keys and Company in Minneapolis. That's about it. Must be another one or two, I can't remember now.
So that was mainly it?
That was mainly it. I mean, now we all had some statistics. And as I say, I had my epidemiology is heavily medical, too heavily medical. On the other hand, quite a lot of the epidemiology I've done was based on the fact that I've been very well trained in morbid anatomy. I've been very well trained in clinical cardiology. I had a remarkable experience in clinical cardiology. I was Thomas Lewis's clerk for nearly a year, and I was his house physician for something. So I had personal coaching from Thomas Lewis for virtually 18 months. And in morbid anatomy, I fell under the influence of the UCH, the man of the London.
Whose records are you?
Who became a remarkable man. My epidemiology quite likely suffered from this medicine. Ansel Keys brought in physiology. Well, I say medicine. It's another branch. Physiology, and it was another branch of medicine. And he brought in physiology and his nutritional aspects of it. So he was a nutritionist essentially, wasn't he? But I regard that as part of medicine. The Framingham people were clinicians. Doran Hill was essentially statisticians. Bradford Hill was a statistician, and Dole was very junior. What else other interests he developed.
And if you were starting today, starting off again, and you could choose any field, not necessarily epidemiology, but with your sort of background, what sort of field do you think would you go into?
Public health.
As opposed to research, purely research-based epidemiology?
Well, in public health, you've got to do a certain amount of research, but hopefully you can do it locally. And if we succeed in our physiological studies, we'll have a whole new apparatus of assessing physical fitness in the population and functional physical capacities. See, the kind of thing that shakes me is that physiologists have discovered years ago this situation of sarcopenia. Do you know what it is? Well, you see, this is typical. This is typical. It's disastrous. As a part of normal aging, there's a loss of muscle mass and of muscle strength, therefore, from the 40s at the latest. This is normal aging. Happens to everybody. the athletes as well as the sluggards. Now it's been demonstrated now by RCTs, of course. They're not going to be cut out. That you can, by exercise, you can make big differences to this. You can, in fact, in these terms, rejuvenate old people by 10, 15 years. Now, public health has totally failed to take this on board. But totally. So, I mean, I did a poll in this school when I first was taught this by my pal, one of my physiological pals. And I just stopped a dozen people in the school. You know, I think it was one of them had heard of it vainly, something to do with them. Exchange rate mechanism or something. I wouldn't expect you to know about sarcopenia, which is a ridiculous term. I mean, it's so unfriendly. But what term would you? You knew about muscle wasting, yeah. Muscle. You knew about that.
Yeah.
But public health
doesn't
at all. Now here's a major. There are a collection of these issues, which public health. Again, in terms of applying all this vast knowledge which we've acquired in recent years. This is fairly recent, and there are beautiful studies in it. And it has been demonstrated beyond. I remember talking to Liam about it. He's interested in so many things.
Well, that's the future, so that's a good place to start.
Thanks for listening to Voices, a project of the journal Epidemiology. We hope you enjoyed it. You may also be interested in a short video clip of this interview, which you can access through the journal's website. An edited version of this interview was published in the November 2004 issue of the journal.